14. Galen. Galen, son of a weaver, came to Buckkeep as a boy. His father was one of Queen Desire's personal servants who followed her from Pharaoh. Solicity was then the skill master at Buckkeep. She had instructed King Bounty and his son Shrewd in the skill, so by the time Shrewd's sons were boys, she was ancient already. She petitioned King Bounty that she might take an apprentice, and he consented. Galen was greatly favored of the queen, and at Queen-in-Waiting Desire's energetic urging, Solicity chose the youth Galen as her apprentice. At that time, as now, the skill was denied to bastards of the Farseer House. But when the talent had bloomed, unexpected, among those not of royalty, it was cultivated and rewarded. No doubt, Galen was such a one as this, a boy showing strange and unexpected talent that came abruptly to the attention of the skillmaster. By the time the prince's chivalry and verity were old enough to receive skill instruction, Galen had advanced enough to assist in their instruction, though he was but a year or so older than they. Once again my life sought a balance and briefly found it. The awkwardness with Lady Patience gradually eroded into our acceptance that we would never become casual or over-familiar with one another. Neither of us felt a need to share feelings. Instead, we skirted one another at a formal distance and nevertheless managed to gain a good mutual understanding. Yet in the formal dance of our relationship, there were occasional times of genuine merriment, and sometimes we even danced to the same piper. Once she had given up the notion of teaching me everything that a Farseer prince should know, she was able to teach me a great deal. Very little of it was what she initially intended to teach me. I did gain a working knowledge of music, but this was by the loan of her instruments and many hours of private experimentation. I became more her runner than her page, and from fetching for her, I learned much of the perfumer's art, as well as greatly increasing my knowledge of plants. Even Chade became enthused when he discovered my new talents for root and leaf propagation, and he followed with interest the experiments, a few of them successful, that Lady Patience and I made into coaxing the buds of one tree to open to leaf when spliced into another tree. This was a magic she had heard rumored, but did not scruple to attempt. To this day in the women's garden, there is an apple tree, one branch of which bears pears. When I expressed a curiosity about the tattooer's art, she refused to let me mark my own body, saying I was too young for such a decision. But without the least qualm, she let me observe, and finally assist with the slow pricking of dye into her own ankle and calf that became a coiled garland of flowers. But all of that evolved over months and years, not days. We had settled into a blunt-spoken courtesy toward one another by the end of 10 days. She met Fedrin and enlisted him in her root paper project. The pup was growing well and was a greater pleasure to me every day. Lady Patience's errands to town gave me ample opportunities to see my town friends, especially Molly. She was an invaluable guide to the fragrant stalls where I purchased Lady Patience's perfume supplies. Forging and Red Ship raiders might still threaten from the horizon, but for those few weeks, they seemed a remote terror, like the remembered chill of winter on a midsummer day. For a very brief period, I was happy, and an even rarer gift, I knew I was happy. And then, my lessons with Galen began. The night before my lessons were to begin, Burridge sent for me. I went to him, wondering what chore I had done poorly and would be rebuked for. I found him waiting for me outside the stables, shifting his feet as restlessly as a confined stallion. He immediately beckoned me to follow him and took me up to his chambers. "Tea," he offered, and when I nodded, poured me a mug from a pot still warm on his hearth. "What's the matter?" I asked as I took it from him. He was strung as tight as I had ever seen him. This was so unlike Burridge that I feared some terrible news, that Sooty was ill or dead. or that he had discovered Smithy.
Nothing.
He lied, and did it so poorly that he himself immediately recognized it.
It's this boy,
he confessed suddenly.
Galen came to me today. He told me that you were to be instructed in the skill, and he charged me that while he was teaching you, I could interfere in no way, not to counsel or ask chores of you, or even share a meal with you. He was most direct about it.
Burrich paused, and I wondered what better word he had rejected. He looked away from me.
There was a time when I'd hoped this chance would be offered you, but when it wasn't, I thought, well, perhaps it's for the best.
Galen can be a hard teacher.
A very hard teacher. I've heard talk of it before. He drives his pupils, but he claims he expects no more of them than he does of himself. And boy, I've heard that gossiped about me, too, if you can credit it.
I permitted myself a small smile that brought an answering scowl from Burrich.
Listen to what I'm telling you.
Galen makes no secret that he has no fondness for you. Of course, he doesn't know you at all, so it's not your fault. It's based solely on what you are and what you caused. And God knows that wasn't your fault. But if Galen admitted that, then he'd have to admit it was chivalry's fault. And I've never known him to admit that chivalry had any faults. But you can love a man and know better than that about him. Burrich took a brisk turn around the room, then came back to the fire.
Just tell me what you want to say, I suggested.
I'm trying, he snapped. It's not easy to know what to say. I'm not even sure if I should be speaking to you. Is this interference or counsel? But your lessons haven't started yet, so I say this now. Do your best for him. Don't talk back to Galen. Be respectful and courteous. Listen to all he says and learn it as well and quickly as you can.
He paused again. I hadn't intended to do otherwise. I pointed out a bit tartly, for I could tell that none of this was what Burrich was trying to say.
I know that fits.
He sighed suddenly and threw himself down at the table opposite me. With the heels of both hands, he pressed at his temples as if pained. I had never seen him so agitated.
A long time ago, I talked to you about that other magic, the wit, the being with the beasts, almost becoming one of them.
He paused and glanced about the room, as if worried someone would hear. He leaned in closer to me and spoke softly but urgently.
Stay clear of it. I've tried my best to get you to see it's shameful and wrong, but I've never really felt that you agreed. Oh, I know you've abided by my rule against it most of the time, but a few times I've sensed, or suspected, that you were tinkering with things no good man touches. I tell you, Fitz, I'd sooner see you forged. Yes, don't look so shocked, that's truly how I feel. And as for Galen, look, Fitz, don't even mention it to him. Don't speak of it. Don't even think of it near him. It's little that I know about the skill and how it works. But sometimes when your father touched me with it, it seemed he knew my heart before I did, and saw things that I kept buried, even from myself.
A sudden deep blush suffused Burrich's dark face, and almost I thought I saw tears stand in his dark eyes. He turned aside from me to the fire, and I sensed we were coming to the heart of what he needed to say, needed, not wanted. There was a deep fear in him, one he denied himself. A lesser man, a man less stern with himself, would have trembled with it.
Fear for you, boy.
He spoke to the stones above the mantelpiece, and his voice was so deep a rumble that I almost couldn't understand him.
Why?
A simple question unlocks best. Chade had taught me.
I don't know if he will see it in you, or what he will do if he does. I've heard I know it's true. There was a woman, actually little more than a girl. She had a way with birds. She lived in the hills to the west of here, and it was said she could call a wild hawk from the sky. Some folk admired her and said it was a gift. They took sick poultry to her, or called her in when hens wouldn't set their eggs. She did aught but good, for all I heard. But Galen spoke out against her, said she was an abomination, and that it would be the worse for the world if she lived to breed. And one morning she was found beaten to death.
Galen did it?
Burrich shrugged, a gesture most unlike him. His horse had been out of the stable that night. That much I know. And his hands were bruised, and he had scratches on his face and neck, but not the scratches a woman would have dealt him, boy. Talon marks, as if a hawk had tried to strike him.
And you said nothing?
I asked incredulously. He barked a bitter laugh. Another spoke before I could. Galen was accused by the girl's cousin, who happened to work here in the stables. Galen would not deny it. They went out to the witness stones and fought one another for El's justice, which always prevails there. Higher than the king's court is the answer to a question settled there, and no one may dispute it. The boy died. Everyone said it was the El's justice, that the boy had accused Galen falsely. One said it to Galen, and he replied that El's justice was that the girl had died before she bred. And her tainted cousin, too.
Burrich fell silent. I was queasy with what he had told me, and a cold fear snaked through me. A question once decided at the witness stones could not be raised again. That was more than law. It was the very will of the gods. So I was to be taught by a man who was a murderer, a man who would try to kill me if he suspected I had the wit.
Yes,
Burrich said, as if I had spoken aloud.
Oh, Fitz, my son, be careful. Be wise.
And for a moment I wondered, for it sounded as if he feared for me. But then he added,
don't shame me, boy, or your father. Don't let Galen say that I've let my prince's son grow up a half-beast. Show him that chivalry's blood runs true in you.
I'll try, I muttered, and I went to bed that night, wretched and afraid. The queen's garden was nowhere near the women's garden, or the kitchen garden, or any other garden in Buckkeep. It was instead atop a circular tower. The garden walls were high on the sides that faced the sea, but to the south and west the walls were low and had seats along them. The stone walls captured the warmth of the sun and fended off the salt winds from the sea. The air was still there, almost as if hands were cupped over my ears. Yet there was a strange wildness to the garden founded on stone. There were rock basins, perhaps bird baths or water gardens at one time, and various tubs and pots and troughs of earth intermingled with statuary. At one time, the tubs and pots had probably overflowed with greenery and flowers. Of the plants, only a few stalks and the mossy earth in the tubs remained. The skeleton of a vine crawled over a half-rotted trellis. It filled me with an old sadness, colder than the first chill of winter that was also here. Patience should have had this, I thought. She would bring life here again. I was the first to arrive. August came soon after. He had Verity's broad build, much as I had chivalry's height, and the dark farseer colouring. As always, he was distant but polite. He dealt me a nod, and then strolled about, looking at the statuary. Others appeared rapidly after him. I was surprised at how many, over a dozen. Other than August, son of the king's sister, no one could boast so much farseer blood as I could. There were cousins and second cousins of both sexes, and both younger and older than I. August was probably the youngest, at least 2 years my junior, and Serene,
a woman in her mid-twenties, was probably the eldest. It was an oddly subdued group, a few clustered, talking softly, but most drifted about, poking at the empty gardens or looking at the statues. Then, Galen came. He let the door of the stairwell slam shut behind him. Several of the others jumped. He stood regarding us, and we in turn looked at him in silence. There is something I have observed about skinny men. Some, like Chade, seem so preoccupied with their lives that they either forget to eat or burn every bit of substance they take in the fires of their passionate fascination with life. But there is another type. One who goes about the world cadaverously, cheeks sunken, bones jutting, and one senses that he so disapproves of the whole of the world that he begrudges every bit of it that he takes inside himself. At that moment, I would have wagered that Galen had never truly enjoyed one bite of food or one swallow of drink in his life. His dress puzzled me. It was opulently rich, with fur at his collar and neck, and amber beading so thick on his vest it would have turned a sword. But the rich fabrics strained over him, the clothing tailored so snugly to him that one wondered if the maker had lacked sufficient fabric to finish the suit. At a time when full sleeves, slashed with colors, were the mark of a wealthy man, he wore his shirt as tight as a cat's skin. His boots were high and fitted to his calves, and he carried a little quirt, as if come straight from riding. His clothing looked uncomfortable, and combined with his thinness to give an impression of stinginess. His pale eyes swept the Queen's garden dispassionately. He considered us, and immediately dismissed us as wanting. He breathed out through his hawk's nose, as does a man facing an unpleasant chore. "Clear a space," he directed us. "Push all this rubbish to one side. Stack it there against the wall. Quickly now. I have no patience with sluggards." And so the last lines of the garden were destroyed. The arrangements of the pots and beds that had been shadows of the little walks and arbors that had once existed here were swept aside. The pots were moved to one side, the lovely little statues stacked crookedly atop them. Galen spoke only once to me. "Hurry up, bastard," he ordered me, as I struggled with a heavy pot of earth, and he brought down his riding crop across my shoulders. It was not much of a blow, more a tap, but it seemed so contrived that I stopped in my efforts and looked at him. "Didn't you hear me?" he demanded. I nodded and went back to moving the pot. From the corner of my eye, I saw his odd look of satisfaction. The blow, I felt, had been a test, but I was not sure if I had passed or failed it. The tower roof became a bare space, with only the green lines of moss and old runnels of dirt to indicate the garden that had been. He directed us to form ourselves into two lines. He ordered us by age and size, and then separated us by sex, putting the girls behind the boys and off to the right. "I will tolerate no distractions or disruptive behavior. You are here to learn, not dally," he warned us. He then spaced us out, having us stretch our arms in all directions to show that there we could not touch one another, not even so much as a fingertip. From this I expected physical exercises would follow, but instead he directed us to stand still, hands at our sides, and attend to him. So as we stood on the cold tower top, he lectured us. "For 17 years I have been skill master of this keep. Before this, my lessons were given to small groups, discreetly. Those who failed to show promise were turned away quietly. During that time, the 6 duchies had no need for more than a handful to be trained. I trained only the most promising, wasting no time on those without talent or discipline, and, for the last 15 years, I have not initiated any into the skill. But evil times are upon us. The Out-Islanders ravage our shores and forge our people. King Shrewd and Prince Verity turn their skill to protecting us. Great are their efforts, and many their successes, though the common folk never even guess at what they do. I assure you, against the minds I have trained, the Out-Islanders stand small chance. A few paltry victories they may have won, coming upon us unprepared, but the forces I have created to oppose them will prevail. His pale eyes burned, and he lifted his hands to the heavens as he spoke. He held a long silence, staring upward, his arms outstretched above his head, as if he clawed down power from the sky itself. Then he let his arms slowly fall. "This I know," he went on in a calmer voice. "This I know. The forces I have created will prevail, but our king, may all gods honor and bless him, doubts me. And as he is my king, I bow to his will. He requires that I seek amongst you of lesser blood to see if there are any with the talent and will, the purity of purpose and sternness of soul, to be trained in the skill. This I will do, for my king has commanded. Legends say, in days of old, there were many trained in the skill, who worked alongside their kings to avert dangers from the land. Perhaps it was truly so. Perhaps the old legends exaggerate. In any case, my king has commanded me to attempt to create such a surplus of skilled ones, and so I will try." He totally ignored the five or so women of our group. Not once did his eyes turn toward them. The exclusion was so obvious, I wondered how they had offended him. I knew Serene slightly, for she also had been an apt pupil of Fedrin. I could almost feel the warmth of her displeasure. In the row beside me, one of the boys shifted. In a flash, Galen leaped in front of him. "Bored, are we? Restless with an old man's talk?"
"Just a cramp in my calf, sir,"
the boy rejoined foolishly. Galen slapped him, a backhand that rocked the boy's head.
"Be quiet and stand still, or leave.
It's all one to me. It's already obvious that you lack the stamina to achieve the skill, but the king has found you worthy to be here, and so I will attempt to teach you." I trembled inside, for when Galen spoke to the boy, it was me he stared at, as if the boy's movement had been my fault somehow. A strong distaste for Galen flooded through me. I had taken blows from Hod in the course of my instruction in staves and swords, and endured discomfort even from Chade as he demonstrated touch spots and strangling techniques and ways to silence a man without disabling him. I'd had my share of cuffs, boots, and swats from Burich, some justified, some the vented frustration of a busy man. But I'd never seen a man strike a boy with such apparent relish as Galen had. I strove to keep my face impassive and to look at him without appearing to stare, for I knew if I glanced away, I'd be accused of not paying attention. Satisfied, Galen nodded to himself, and then resumed his lecture. To master the skill, he must first teach us to master ourselves. Physical deprivation was his key. Tomorrow, we were to arrive before the sun was over the horizon. We were not to wear shoes, socks, cloaks, nor any woolen garment. Heads were to be uncovered. The body must be scrupulously clean. He exhorted us to imitate him in his eating and living habits. We would avoid meat, sweet fruit, seasoned dishes, milk, and frivolous foods. He advocated porridges and cold water, plain breads and stewed root vegetables. We would avoid all unnecessary conversation, especially with those of the other sex. He counseled us long against any sort of sensual longings, in which he included desiring food, sleep, or warmth. And he advised us that he had arranged for a separate table to be set for us in the hall, where we might eat appropriate food and not be distracted by idle talk or questions. The last phrase he added almost like a threat. He then put us through a series of exercises. Close the eyes and roll your eyeballs up as far as they would go. Strive to roll them all the way around to look into the back of one's own skull. Feel the pressure this created. Imagine what you might see if you could roll your eyes that far. Was what you saw worthy and correct? Eyes still closed. Stand on one leg. Strive to remain perfectly still. Find a balance, not just of body, but of spirit. Drive from the mind all unworthy thoughts, and you could remain like this indefinitely. As we stood, eyes always closed, going through these various exercises, he moved among us. I could track him by the sound of the riding crop. "Concentrate," he would command us, or "try, at least try." I myself felt the crop at least 4 times that day. It was a trifling thing, little more than a tap, but it was unnerving to be touched with a lash, even without pain. Then the last time it fell, it was high on my shoulder, and the lash of it coiled against my bare neck, while the tip caught me on the chin. I winced, but managed to keep my eyes closed and my precarious balance on one aching knee. As he walked away, I felt a slow drip of warm blood form on my chin. He kept us all day, releasing us when the sun was a half copper on the horizon and the winds of night were rising. Not once had he excused us for food, water, or any other necessity. He watched us file past him, a grim smile on his face, and only when we were through the door did we feel free to stagger and flee down the staircase. I was famished, my hands swollen red with the chill, and my mouth so dry I couldn't have spoken if I had wished to. The others seemed much the same, though some had suffered more acutely than I. I at least was used to long hours, many of them outdoors. Mary, a year or so older than I, was accustomed to helping Mistress Hasty with the weaving. Her round face was more white than red with the cold, and I heard her whisper something to Serene, who took her hand as we went down the stairs. "It wouldn't have been so bad if he had paid any attention to us at all," Serene whispered back. And then I had the unpleasant experience of seeing them both glance back fearfully, to see if Galen had seen them speak to one another. Dinner that night was the most cheerless meal I had ever endured at Buckkeep. There was a cold porridge of boiled grain, bread, water, and boiled mashed turnips. Galen, not eating, presided over our meal. There was no conversation. I don't think we even looked at one another. I ate my allotted portions and left the table almost as hungry as I had arrived. Halfway up the stairs, I remembered Smithy. I returned to the kitchen to get the bones and scraps Cook saved for me, and a pitcher of water to refill his dish. They seemed an awful weight as I climbed the stairs. It struck me as strange that a day of relative inactivity out in the cold had wearied me as much as a day of strenuous work. Once I was inside my room, Smithy's warm greeting and eager consumption of the meat was like a healing balm. As soon as he had finished eating, we snuggled into bed. He wanted to bite and tussle, but soon gave up on me. I let sleep claim me, and woke with a jolt to darkness, fearing that I had slept too long. A glance at the sky told me I could beat the sun to the rooftop, but just barely. No time to wash myself or eat or clean up after Smithy, and it was just as well Galen had forbidden shoes and socks, for I had no time to put mine on. I was too tired even to feel a fool as I raced through the keep and up the stairs of the tower. I could see others hurrying before me by wavering torchlight, and when I emerged from the stairwell, Galen's quirt fell on my back. It bit unexpectedly sharp through my thin shirt. I cried out in surprise as much as pain. "Stand like a man and master yourself, bastard," Galen told me harshly, and the quirt fell again. Everyone else had resumed their places of the day before. They looked as weary as I, and most, too, looked as shocked as I felt by Galen's treatment of me. To this day I don't know why, but I went silently to my place and stood there facing Galen. "Whoever comes last is late and will be treated so," he warned us. It struck me as a cruel rule, for the only way to avoid his quirt tomorrow was to arrive early enough to see it fall on one of my fellows. There followed another day of discomfort and random abuse. So I see it now. So I think I knew it then, in my heart of hearts. But ever he spoke of proving us worthy, of making us tough and strong. He made it an honor to be standing out in the cold, bare feet going numb against the chill stone. He roused in us a competition, not just against each other, but against his shabby images of us. "Prove me wrong," he said over and over. "I beg you, prove me wrong, that I may show the king at least one pupil worthy of my time." And so we tried. How strange now to look back on it all and wonder at myself. But in the space of one day he had succeeded in isolating us and plunging us into another reality, where all rules of courtesy and common sense were suspended. We stood silently in the cold, in various uncomfortable positions, eyes closed, wearing little more than our undergarments. And he walked among us, dealing out cuts from his silly little whip and insults from his nasty little tongue. He cuffed occasionally, or shoved, something that is much more painful when one is chilled to the bone. Those who flinched or wavered were accused of weakness. During the day he berated us with our unworthiness and repeated that he had only consented to try to teach us at the king's behest. The women he ignored, and though he often spoke of past princes and kings who had wielded the skill in defense of the realm, he never once mentioned the queens and princesses who had done likewise. Nor did he ever once give us an overview of what he was attempting to teach us. There was only the cold and the discomfort of his exercises, and the uncertainty of when we would be struck. Why we struggled to endure it, I don't know. So quickly were we all made accomplices in our own degradation. The sun finally ventured once again toward the horizon, but Galen had saved two final surprises for us that day. He let us stand, open our eyes, and stretch freely for a few moments. Then he gave us a final lecture, this one to warn us against those among us who would undermine the training of all by foolish self-indulgences. He walked slowly among us as he spoke, wending his way in and out of our rows, and I saw many a rolling eye and intake of breath as he passed. Then, for the first time that day, he ventured over to the women's corner of the court. "Some," he cautioned us as he strolled, "think themselves above rules. They think themselves worthy of special attention and indulgences. Such illusions of superiority must be driven from you before you can learn anything. It is hardly worthy of my time for me to have to teach these lessons in such laggards and dolts as need them. It is a shame that they have even found their way into our gathering. But they are among us, and I will honor the will of my king and attempt to teach them, even though there is only one way I know to waken such lazy minds." To Mary, he gave two quick cuts with the quirt, but Serene he shoved down onto one knee and struck four times. To my shame, I stood there with the rest as each cut fell, and hoped only that she would not cry out and bring more punishment on herself. But Serene rose, swayed once, and then stood again, still, looking out over the heads of the girls before her. I breathed a sigh of relief. But then, Galen was back, circling like a shark around a fishing boat, speaking now of those who thought themselves too good to share the discipline of the group, of ones who indulged in meat and plenty, while the rest limited ourselves to wholesome grains and pure foods. I wondered, uneasily, who had been so foolish as to visit the kitchen after hours. Then I felt the hot lick of the whip on my shoulders. If I had thought he was using the lash to his full capability before, he proved me wrong now. "You thought to deceive me. You thought I would never know if cook saved her precious pet a plate of tidbits, did you? But I know all that happens in Buckkeep. Don't deceive yourself about that." It dawned on me that he was speaking of the meat scraps I had taken up to Smithy. "The food wasn't for me," I protested, and then could have bitten my tongue out. His eyes glittered coldly.
You'd lie to save yourself a little just pain. You'll never master the skill. You'll never be worthy of it. But the king has commanded that I try to teach, and so I will try, despite you or your low birth.
In humiliation, I took the welts he dealt me. He berated me as each fell, telling the others that the old rules against teaching the skills to a bastard had been to prevent just such a thing as this. Afterward I stood, silent and shamed, as he went down the rows dealing a perfunctory swat with the quirt to each of my fellows, explaining as he did so that we all must pay for the failures of the individuals. It did not matter that this statement made no sense, or that the whip fell lightly compared with what Galen had just inflicted on me. It was the idea that they were all paying for my transgression. I had never felt so shamed in my life. Then he released us, to go down to another cheerless meal, much the same as yesterday's. This time, no one spoke on the stairs, or at the meal. And afterward, I went straight up to my room.
Meet soon,
I promised the hungry pup that waited for me. Despite my aching back and muscles, I forced myself to clean up the room, scrubbing up Smithy's messes, and then making a trip for fresh stewing reeds. Smithy was a bit sulky at being left alone all day, and I was troubled when I realized I had no idea how long this miserable training would last. I waited until late, when all ordinary folk of the keep were in their beds, before venturing down to get Smithy's food for him. I dreaded that Galen would find out. But what else was I to do? I was halfway down the staircase when I saw the glimmering of a single candle being borne toward me. I shrank against the wall, suddenly sure it was Galen. But it was the fool who came toward me, glowing as white and pale as the wax candle he carried. In his other hand was a pail of food and a beaker of water balanced atop it. Soundlessly, he waved me back to my room. Once inside, the door shut, he turned on me.
I can take care of the pup for you, he told me dryly. But I can't take care of you. Use your head, boy. What can you possibly learn from what he's doing to you?
I shrugged, then winced. It's just a toughness. I don't think it will go on much longer before he gets down to actually teaching us. I can take it. Then, wait, I said, as he fed bits of meat to Smithy from the pail. How do you know what Galen's been putting us through?
Ah, that would be telling, he said bitterly, and I can't do that.
Tell, that is. He dumped the rest of the pail out for Smithy, replenished his water, and stood.
I'll feed the puppy, he told me. I'll even try to take him outside for a bit each day, but I won't clean up his messes.
He paused at the door.
That's where I draw the line. You'd better decide where you will draw the line, and soon, very soon. The danger is greater than you know.
And then he was gone, taking his candle and warnings with him. I lay down and fell asleep to the sounds of Smithy worrying a bone and making puppy growls to himself.